Well, I can't promise you a fire alarm tonight. And most of you heard that that's what happened at the beginning of Carolyn Fouché's reading last week. But we came back in about half an hour later and carried on, and it was a great evening. But it's really wonderful to see everyone here tonight to come out to hear one of our own poets, and probably the most well-known poet in the history of Michigan State. The Poetry Center is really happy to have hosted this series of four readings and to conclude with the one tonight with Diane Wachowski. I want to make a couple of announcements before we get on with the evening and let you know, if you haven't seen, that there is food in the back, which you should feel free to partake of after the reading. And we're also selling Poetry Center T-shirts. We're selling Diane's books. We're selling the books by all the people who've read during the series. Who knows what all is back there? It seems to increase exponentially during the series. There are also some freebies back there. We handed you, as you came in the door, we hope, a couple of bookmarks highlighting two of the poets we're bringing during National Poetry Month in April. And we have a low profile until April, although we have some very interesting things going on that we're going to try to get the word out about. But in April, we will have, during the first week of April, Rick Mulkey, who's a poet from South Carolina. And the second week of April will be Jane Taylor, who's a poet from Oklahoma. The last week of April will be Carol Davis, who won the T.S. Eliot Award for her book Into the Arms of Pushkin last year, and who Diane Wachowski blurbed the back of the book. So that's a really wonderful and fortuitous connection. And during the third week in April, it's going to be student poetry reading week. So we're going to have a lot going on with student poets. So if you are a student, stay connected to us so you may be part of all that. I want to, as we bring this inaugural series to a close, I want to once again thank everybody in the Residential College who has made this possible, and particularly Dean Steve Esquith and the administrative staff in the office, and all of the people on the Poetry Center Programming Board who are students, and a couple of members from the community who have worked very long and very hard to make all this possible, and we wouldn't be here tonight without them. To introduce our renowned poet tonight, I'm going to introduce Martha Bates, who's the acquisitions editor for the MSU Press, who has known Diane for a very long time, and who I think is practically single-handedly responsible for keeping poetry alive and well at the MSU Press. And I think all of us owe her a lot for keeping that going, and hopefully we'll be able to form a very strong bond between the Residential College and the MSU Press. So, Martha?
My goodness. Before I introduce Diane, I have a little preamble. I was watching the news last night, and I learned that Kanye West's mother died. And I like Kanye West, and his mother seemed nice. She was an English professor. But they were convening this symposium of four experts to speculate on her cause of death. They didn't even know what her cause of death was. They were just speculating on it. And yet, a major writer of the 20th century died over the weekend with barely a blip. I didn't agree with about 80% of what Norman Mailer said, but I'm happy to have shared the world with him. He had an artist's sensibility, he set artistic goals, and he wrote at times like a dream. If you read him now, especially his early works, which were so influential, you might find him dated. I think that's because he engaged with a cultural mythos that has so dramatically changed that it has almost disappeared. But he lived in his world, and he was a uniquely American voice. Which brings me to Diane Wachowski, who is also a uniquely American voice in the Whitmanesque tradition. She's created her own personal mythology, and she's actually presented us with this cheat sheet tonight, which is helpful, in order to turn her personal experiences into art. She uses archetypal figures and symbols to explore her major themes: betrayal, survival, loss, anger, beauty, love. Her symbolism and her magical use of language, as well as her willingness to follow where the magic leads her, resonate throughout her body of work, so that while each poem is a jewel, her work as a whole is a many-faceted emerald. Diane's poetry is not easy. It's not facile. Each word is chosen, each poem is honed, so that when you read it, you engage with each image, each thought. You engage with the poet's heart and mind. This is one of the reasons why your poetry is so rewarding and why you can come to it again and again. The mark of a true artist, coming to it again and again and finding something new and dazzling. Diane also lives in her world, like Mailer, and is of it. She was born in August, and she epitomizes the sign of Leo. She can roar like a lion, and she fiercely protects her cubs. Friends, other poets, students, her work, her beliefs. She's not a political poet. She hates that. But she reflects the time in which she lives as she also fashions something that stands beyond time, art. Diane has published over 40 books of poetry, including Inside the Blood Factory, The Collected Greeds, Parts 1 to 13, Argonaut Rose, The Emerald City of Las Vegas, Jason the Sailor, Medea the Sorcerer, which those four comprise the archaeology of movies and books, which is a sequence, a collection of selected poems, Emerald Ice, which is available here tonight, and The Butcher's Apron. A critic said of The Butcher's Apron that you can't read it all at once, but you should dip into it, which I disagree with. I think you should read it all at once and over again. Diane wrote in her essay, The Blue Swan, an essay on music and poetry, that first comes the story, then comes the reaction to the story, then comes the telling and the retelling of the story, and finally comes boredom with the story so that we invent music, and the nature of music is that you must hear all the digressions. Please join me in welcoming Diane Wachowski.
I see Martha wore her Bard College t-shirt, which one of my oldest friends in poetry, Robert Kelly, has always taught at Bard College and holds a special place for me. I'm going to read an introduction that I wrote tonight about creating a personal mythology to give you a little sense of what I've been trying to do and some idea about it, because this whole new manuscript that I'm working on, The Diamond Dog, uses the figure, and I wanted you to have a little preparation for it. Though poets are more likely to use their own lives as subject matter than fiction writers might be, most of us are not writing autobiography or even documenting our lives. For the most part, we poets are only using our lives to create a personal mythology. Here's a little history of mine. It started when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley in the late 50s. I was drowning in secret sadness that came from my having gotten pregnant by my high school boyfriend, then going to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers to have my child, and giving him up for adoption at birth in 1956. In the 50s, this was a shameful secret in my lower middle class world, and it overwhelmed me, even though I felt I had done the right thing in an impossible situation. I was writing poetry, but I didn't have any idea of how to speak of this overwhelming event in my life. And despite subsequent critics who have sometimes called me a confessional poet, I did not even dream of confessing or admitting this story in my poems. Truth teller I am, but I don't disclose my secrets. I took the leap into personal mythology when I was studying poetry with Tom Gunn at Berkeley. It suddenly occurred to me that I could invent a persona in a poem to tell my story, but I could disguise the story. I could represent it differently. At that time, I had fallen for the novels of Thomas Mann, and in particular, I loved The Holy Sinner, a story of brother and sister and their taboo love. I co-opted that story for my own. It had taboo love, a sad, if not tragic, ending. And it was about romance and intense passion, and most of all, about loss. So for my poem called Justice is Reason Enough, I wrote about the death of my twin brother, David, by suicide after we had committed the taboo act of incest. I was creating a personal myth about myself. For me, the story wasn't fiction. It was my life, but reinvented. I didn't really have a brother. It was the first time I dared to overtly write about the pain of losing someone I loved, in particular, a man. The next occasion when I created personal myth was in the early 60s in New York City, where I was living with minimalist sculptor and painter Robert Morris. I think I knew that he was leaving me, and I wanted to write poems about men in my life who left me, starting with my father, who was gone most of my childhood because he was in the Navy, and then gone later on because he and my mother divorced when I was 13. I decided to use the phrase from popular history about George Washington, the father of our country. I wrote a group of poems in which I turned the various men in my life into George Washington, using details of Washington's life to represent them and my relationships to them. The most anthologized of the George Washington poems is The Father of My Country. In the 70s, once again, I turned to a story outside of my own biography, this time to create a mythic persona for myself. In high school, I had fallen in love with California poet Robinson Jeffers' translation of Euripides' Medea, and I began to see the story of my giving up my children for adoption as a version of Medea's story. This archetype of the woman who loves a man who takes her, then leaves her, a woman who then kills her children rather than being exiled alone with them, seemed to represent an extreme version of my own story. Over the years, I have invented other mythic figures to stud my poems, the King of Spain, that figure from fairy tale of the desirable man who, in my case, is invisible and always follows me with protection and love. And most notably, I invented a figure whom I refer to as the motorcycle betrayer. There have been others, and perhaps there will be more, but last year I discovered an image in the George Washington poem, Father of My Country, which has me working elaborately again with personal myth. It is the image of the diamond dog, which I allude to in that poem. The diamond dog is an image from a dream I had when I was about 6 years old, when my mother and sister and I lived in East Whittier, California, in a little shack that was next door to a big house where the owner of the surrounding orange groves lived. In those days, there was no trash collection. Trash and garbage were burned in back of the house, where there were large metal drums for the burning. When the drums filled with accumulated ash, the ash was dumped nearby on the ground. In my dream, it was out of one of these ash heaps that this dog, it was a little Scotty-shaped dog, made out of a huge diamond, leaped and ran away. In my dream, the diamond dog was following my father as he left us. I am sure I remembered the dream all those years because the dog somehow symbolized the masculinity in my life, departing, running away from me. In the dream, the dog was following my father. And in my mind, of course, together, they were the symbol of all masculinity, leaving me forever. I should interject here a reminder that personal mythology is not autobiography, even if it uses it. For 30 years, I have lived with a man, Robert Turney, my husband, who cherishes me as a father would and who never makes me fear he will leave me. But in poems, we work with the archetypes and patterns that shape us and out of which we tell our stories. In creating a personal mythology, we give ourselves to the bigger stories, though we often use the small details of our everyday world to do so. It's not just the Freudian father romance that shapes my poems. It is also the Jungian sense of the anima and the animus, the two parts that make a whole, the masculine and feminine. My myths grew out of my youthful fear of living in an all-female world where one could not have the balance of anima and animus. The poems I'm going to read tonight are part of an almost finished manuscript called The Diamond Dog. So far, my plan is that every poem in the book uses some allusion, no matter how minute, to the figure of the diamond dog. I'll be reading 12 of these poems, and it should take just about an hour. You have on the handout from the door, possibly an encouragement to buy Emerald Ice, although many of my old friends in the audience obviously own a copy. But the poems that I'm going to read tonight are not yet in print, whereas there are many poems using my personal mythology in Emerald Ice, and I made a little list of some of those uses of personal mythology. On that same sheet, you have what I'm going to read right now, which is the segment, the small segment from The Father of My Country, which is the provenance for the Diamond Dog. My father, because I dreamed in one night that I dug through the ash heap in back of the pepper tree and found a diamond shaped like a dog, and my father called the dog, and it came leaping over to him, and he walked away out of the yard down the road with the dog jumping and yipping at his heels. My father was not in the telephone book in my city. My father was not sleeping with my mother at home. My father did not care if I studied the piano. My father did not care what I did. But I thought my father was handsome, and I loved him, and I wondered why he left me alone so much. The first book in the manuscript is called Black Ships Drawn Up on a White Beach. The title is a phrase that I found in a wonderful chapter from an unpublished novel. The novel's unpublished. This chapter was published in a magazine called Pleiades. A man named Zachary Mason is writing something that he calls the Lost Books of the Odyssey, and he purports that Odysseus had more adventures than we get at the Odyssey, some after he returns and some before, and these are the Lost Books. They're interesting, but even more, they're very beautifully written, or what I've read so far. In this poem, I want you to picture the landscape that I begin with. My life has been full of adventure since 2000, when my biological daughter tracked me down after 10 years and found me and then tracked down my biological son. And I've been meeting people from the past and finding out stories and having an amazing time. I decided as part of this adventure that since Robert and I go out to the West Coast annually for a little odyssey, that we should stop up and visit in a kind of non-threatening situation my high school boyfriend, who was the biological father of my son. And I hadn't seen him, of course, for 50 years. And we arranged a perfect meeting. We sat on a wall in front of the Pacific Ocean and had a picnic lunch. And so that's the scene that I'm visualizing here at the beginning. It happens to be in Northern California, which is in an area just north of where Robinson Jeffers, who's one of my great poetry heroes, lived. He lived in Carmel before it was the rich and expensive town that Clint Eastwood became the mayor of. And he lived on the coast working with the mythology of the Portuguese fishermen there in his wonderful long story poems. And the point that you need to know is that one of the things that he did which made him so unique was that he built a stone tower with his own hands on this property overlooking the ocean next to Tor House, the house he lived in. Black ships drawn up on a white beach. Take me there, Oh, take me there, to the seawall in Robin's and Jeffers' country. We were like cypresses, wind-silhouetted on the rocky coast, like ships whose green is almost black. Not like an old man and an old woman, though bending away from the wind like the Monterey cypresses. I was watching surfers, not black ships. The long beach was white, and further down the coast was the poet's stone tower. Now that I am not on that coastline anymore, looking out the window has assumed such importance, as if I were in a tower like Rapunzel, yet no length of braid could any longer draw you up, you who are never the same person. I'd like to send a letter to the King of Spain, the man who remains constant because he is from a fairy tale. I want to tell him about the diamond dog who followed my father out of my life, how the dog runs away every time I call him, or used to. Angela tells me there is a white dwarf star with a core of diamond 2,500 square miles in diameter. It is located in the constellation Centaurus and is 50 light years from Earth. She says the cosmic gem is the remains of a star that was once much like our sun. How lucky to have a father who sailed away rather than one who was a disappointment in the flesh. There is great drama possible when lies are told, for the everyday need not intervene its dull self. Living dogs slather, smell fuggish, shed hair, jump on clean clothes or furniture with muddy paws, lick your face, sniff your crotch, but a diamond dog is a little piece of crystalline motion running like a starship, white on the black beach. Odysseus, the father, returned after 20 years of sailing, had sailor's eyes and saw everything, but he would not have seen the diamond dog had it followed him. Oh, take me there. Take me to the star in the Horseman constellation, whose core is miles of diamond. There I'd be able to see the black ships drawn up on a white beach, drawn close to me, I lingering on this seawall, they not furling their sails or running away from me. This next short poem is the title poem for the collection. I don't know that I need to tell you anything about it, although I suppose the diamond dog. He hasn't jumped yet. His square-cut body, like a calving glacier, hasn't glitter-struck you, hasn't revealed its malachite striations, its contradictions of transparency. Once I walked on the Mendenhall Glacier. Fear clothed me. Rubber boots, yellow slicker over wool-hooded sweatshirt, all made of fear's cloth. As I looked down into the water, fathomless as my anger about the past, water I had to step over from the boat to glacier shelf. Little dog, you were not there. Or I could have stepped on your back naked, shedding the clothes of trepidation. I could have ridden you, diamond dog, over, past, and away, leaving behind all the blame and regret of betrayals. The house in the orange grove, the ash heap from which we both came. This next poem is a longer poem. It's in two parts. It's called Amber Discs, and those of you who know me know how much I love amber. I'm sporting some of it tonight. My husband gives me beautiful amber jewelry, and I have always preferred these semi-precious stones to diamonds. But the amber discs I refer to in this title are those aviator sunglasses that I wore in the 60s and 70s. Lots of people wore them. I probably started the fashion, no? As I am sure that I'm the one who made blue jeans popular. at any rate. This poem is for my high school friend, Reg Dunlap, another delightful adventure that has happened to me since 2000. I gave a poetry reading at the KGB in New York City in a blizzard, and Reg, my old friend from my high school creative writing class in 1954, I think, there he was. I hadn't seen him probably since 1956, and he was a taxi driver. He is a taxi driver in New York, although I think he's sort of retired now. But what this poem uses is what to me is the most fascinating thing about his life, although, believe me, he has had an interesting life, much more interesting than mine. And of course, what attracted my attention for these poems is the sailor figure, as in My Sailor Father. He built his own sailboat from scratch with wood by hand, and then lived on it for, I don't know, 20 years or so. But because he's an old hippie and he doesn't have things like insurance, he hardly has an income, when his sailboat was destroyed in a hurricane in Long Island Sound where he lived, it was just gone. And this poem is the first part of it and the second part of it are both about how hard it is for me to accept someone who can just leave something behind. And, of course, this has all to do with my father mythology. There is one thing that you need to know in this first part of the poem. Some of you know about Egyptian mythology, but if you don't, or if you don't remember, the figure of night in Egyptian mythology is represented as a beautiful, tall, black woman who is called Nut. And night is the canopy of her body arched over, of course, flat world, which the sun travels around in his boat. So this section one of Amber Discs is called The Sky as a Ceiling. Living on a sailboat, you must have seen every night Egyptian Nut stretched and bent over the earth, her blackness, her ancient night sky. But you were cloaked in air. The furled masts were finite risings. The sun itself had disappeared, resting in another boat just under the horizon. Or am I only imagining what I might have seen, needing to feel roofed to explain the empty sky? Without myth, there is no canopy or black woman curved over the flat earth. Only the blue lack of restraint. The floating away, the fear of no tether. If I had to sleep on the water, I'd be aware below of the deck between my body and the ocean's bottom, and above the sky's curving ceiling holding me against a void. But I never have done much of anything outdoors. Can anyone say he lives in a natural world when it's enclosed under a roof? In a building. No wonder I am restless and animals terrify me. There is nothing in my life that's wilderness or sky without a limit. I am all caution, a machine carefully put away, not left out in what we call the elements. I never experience an unroofed world. I've often wondered, my friend, if you invented your outdoor life, building and living on a sailboat that after 20 years was lost in a hurricane. But if you didn't, and when I see you riding your bicycle in Manhattan, for you embrace the wind in your face, even in rough weather, as if you are sailing, I think you didn't, and continue to be baffled about why you don't spend every day longing for the past. You told me once you think like a scientist, which I don't. And I know you were a successful navigator, which I could never be. so probably you won't understand what makes me so fearful. For me, night is not benevolent, enclosed by a beautiful woman arched over our earth. It is Blake's tiger hunting for human food, or night is a bat of some giant species ready to enfold and poison me with black wings twice the size of continents. Even air might be the breath from a dragon that really is the earth's surface, as on medieval maps, and thus my breathing is always shallow, contained. On the water, a boat moves visibly. Not the way we know we are in motion but never feel it. The earth on its axis, making its diurnal rotation from Newt's toes to her ebony head. If the sky surrounded, wrapped, enclosed, roofed, or canopied the boat, earth would have to be flat, the horizon a wall, an edge over which we'd tumble. That's the world I suppose I'd prefer to live in, not one always in motion, without beginning or end. The woman who disappears in La Ventura and is never found, nor do we ever know what happened or why. Nothing is weighed or resolved. Ironically, I loved that film, not realizing it was about everything I most fear. Huddled under my always roofed life, I can only whisper, "Help me." Imagine you standing at night on the deck of your catamaran. You for whom the night and the open air imply no ceiling, no beautiful restraint. The second part of this poem, called Central Fire and Ellipses, is for one of my wonderful sapphos who is here tonight, Courtney Chapin, who is chiding me about my solipsistic view of the world and my sense that everyone ought to feel the same things that I do, or wondering why they don't. In your voice of French croissants, Courtney, you say, "He's been there, done that, just moves on." You're right. I cannot wrap my mind around the way he never feels regret. You're right. For me, the world isn't linear, though I might prefer it that way. We orbit, or events do, sometimes in long ellipses, but I anticipate each return, can't imagine not returning. I worry that my old friend focused his life around building a wooden sailboat, spent 20 years working and living on it, then lost it. How can he look back without regret? Why doesn't he want to retrieve it? I see him, an old man, riding his bicycle in the city and wonder if he thinks he's on deck. I imagine him climbing the stairs to his third floor walk-up apartment. Is he shimmying up a mast or ascending to a deck from below? My voice, a lemon tart. How can he just leave it all behind? It was his passion. Courtney smiles her French braid smile. Doesn't have to pronounce what I am revealing, that I know this is my problem, not what is wrong with him. My father, the sailor, just left his family and never looked back. Moved on without regrets. Though even that isn't entirely true, is it, Diane? I'm talking to myself now. Remember that summer week in Vallejo with his new family when you were in high school? You, prissy, and acting as if you were wearing white gloves while having royal tea? Remember when you were in college, his appearing in his Navy uniform outside your window one afternoon when his ship was in port for just half an hour? Weren't you the one who turned your back? So, Diane, I'm still talking to myself. You know when there is perturbation of the orbit, say from other gravitational pulls, that a planet doesn't always seem to do the expected. You always expected the motorcycle betrayer to return, yet never answered his letter that came once when your back was retrograde. Why do you have such a hard time accepting your friend's practicality? Yes? Why does it bother me that my old friend doesn't say he wishes all the time he still lived on his boat or with the woman who lived with him then, or talk sadly of any other betrayals, including the hurricane itself? Betrayal? That's your word, Diane. Now Courtney has her cafe au lait voice, soothing. It troubles you that he lives in the moment, rejoices in what life gives him, doesn't dwell on what he had in the past. She's still smiling at me as I try to fit everything into one proof, no matter how many steps it takes. But there is no diamond dog to constantly rise up out of the ash heap and follow a sailor father walking through the palm trees out of someone's life. My friend, he himself is like a little dog, panting heavily after his bicycle rides, eagerly barking for attention and happy to be outdoors, bouncing with energy, sniffing at everything new. The central fire around which he orbits is curiosity. He doesn't care if it's sea air or city traffic. Each breath is new, orbital, glittery, all the stars in the cosmos. But I focus on only a dream I had when I was 6 years old, the twinkle of my diamond dog disappearing with my father, the sailor. This next poem, I should just interject here that I am so privileged in many ways, but one of them that I will mention tonight is that over the years I've been forming groups of poets who come out of my workshops and classes, and two of the most ongoing groups who currently meet with me are my Sapphos and my New Alchemists, and many of them are here tonight. And thank you for helping me so much with the poems. And the Angela who told me about the diamond that's 2,500 miles wide is a New Alchemist. And this, the inspiration and some of the substance in this poem I owe to a very interesting poetry student, Leslie Anderson, who was in my class last spring. She told us something in class that totally intrigued me, and so I used it for this poem. Thank you, Leslie. The poem is called No Way to Trace the Provenance, and obviously of this group of poems, and my interest is in the way we look back and find our sources and what we come out of and how that affects us and so forth. No way to trace the provenance. When I look in the mirror, I don't see the pedigree. His diamond-shaped face, her lips like a cup of raspberries. Instead, there is the foot so white I'd like to call it Pegasus. Gray, she tells me. Pegasus is gray. Only albinos can be called white horses. All others, they are gray. And she's right. No one seems to know this, how such arcane purity of terminology was set and then ignored by all but breeders. You think you know where a certain scar comes from, but perhaps it's the spectrum now that is proofer, paper of entitlement, pedigree. You always elude me, Father. Return to a Poland covered with snow, your eyes shielded by two amber disks. I, the little girl who thought she loved horses, but dreamed the diamond dog instead of winged Pegasus. I guess like all little girls, I thought I loved horses, but I don't think I was ever within 6 feet of one. No. And, of course, Pegasus is the horse of poetry, but I didn't dream of Pegasus. This next poem I also owe big debts to two of my Sapphos, maybe to others too, but in particular, Ruth Mowry helped me with this poem by allowing me to create one of my argumentative dialogues with her about the choice of a certain word, I'm proud to say I beat her down, and she finally agreed that it was the perfect word, but it's probably because I put it at a different place in the poem. And the other is another of my Sappho's, Carrie Preston, who herself is married to a military man and insisted that I needed to have more of the military sense of my father in this poem. It's called A Military Daughter Steals the Pulsing of Linden Leaves. And among the many, many fears that I have grown up with and continued to cherish, I think, in my life, I'm afraid of trees. And I think it's because the leaves are always moving. We're not going to have a Q&A afterwards. So I will address one of the dumbest questions that is always asked at a Q&A, and that is, where do you get your ideas? I mean, maybe we'd like to know that, but neurologists would probably be better to answer that question than we would. But in fact, the idea for this poem, it comes from something that often works for me, images that just stay in my mind. And I don't, even with all my Freudian, Jungian, how can I analyze this as much as possible tendencies, sometimes I just can't tell you why that image is there. This image is from 1969 when I was in Mallorca, which is where I met Robert Turney, my husband. But it's not anything significant. One day, a woman and I went over to a neighboring village. It was at siesta hour time. And the village, we were walking around the village square, and it was totally empty. And the trees were this very bright green-leaved variety. They were lindens, I think. And I just have carried that image of those trees and the leaves. And I suppose in a sense this poem explores a little bit about how we steal our images to shape them into something that will give us some sense of, I don't know, revelation. The poem is in three short parts. A military daughter steals the pulsing of linden trees. Part one, leaves as the matador's stolen cape. In my tight blue trousers and striped T-shirt, I stood there like a shoplifter and deftly pocketed this image. The street with siesta abandoned cafe chairs, the leaves of the lindens green as Garcia Lorca's wind, silence like bread dough rising, a matador behind shuttered windows, his gold cape flung as if it were a leaf blown against my eyes before they fan shut and take away these stolen pages that I look at now in privacy, this text secreted and untranslated. I was warned, but did not comprehend how it might become my uniform, this constantly pulsing cape of linden leaves that I pilfered from the trees. Part two, the leaves themselves. But I knew when I saw those linden trees, bright as limeade, lining the Spanish afternoon street, empty of the Guardia Civil in their patent leather hats, and my father already vanished with a whistle to my diamond dog following him. I knew, yet did not know, what I would take with me. The leaves, their sound like lovers stirring against dry sheets, like my white feet on the morning stairs, like hair brushing against a gloved hand, like an iced summer drink, like words the departed never spoke. Hush, hush, don't fabricate, Diane. It's only a moment, but could have been a connection. Part three, what is written on the leaves? On that stolid Spanish afternoon, Neither the soldiers nor the police were there. The streets as empty of military presence as my life was empty of my uniformed father, the chief petty officer. Is that when the King of Spain first whispered to me? Shouldn't I have known the words on the leaves were a warning in ghost text? Not an offer of apples or even crushed grapes from the surrounding vineyards breathing in the heat. Yes, I should have known. The snake silent movement of leaves always makes me shiver. In the past, I've written dutifully or negatively about my mother, thanking her for piano lessons, even though I couldn't really love her. And in these poems, I decided, even though they're dominated by the father-daughter romance, that the mother should have a place in them somewhere. And so I created a kind of fairy tale image of my mother. My mother was old when I was born. She was 32. And I always remember an old and silent and difficult woman. But when she was young, she loved to dance. She met my father dancing. And so I'm trying to give her a little of that magic in these poems. This one is called The Silver Locket, and it's meant to sound like a fairy tale or something from the magic world. On the hillside where goats threaded their way through rocks, their bells making the sounds of rattling keys, she awoke with a silver locket. Inside this silver dollop was the face of a Greek mariner who loved her. Rags left from the wedding so many years ago before her enchantment hung around her waist. A scrap of dancing shoe embraced her foot. She couldn't remember why they said the stars turned in crystal spheres or that fire was invisible, but she danced in cream satin shoes. That she remembered. And my little black shoes were gleaming crow feathers, or the noses of seals, or jet or onyx lamps filled with oil, the kind Aladdin found. After the library at Alexandria was torched, there were 8 centuries of brindled flocks. She who was my mother and told me this story, as I sat by the smudged-leaved orange groves and watched black and gold spiders make webs, had come through a portal, a cone, and thus awakened with only the silver locket. The rosebush was part of her story, and the diamond dog who ran through the yard one evening at dusk, reading of Queen Anne's lace, she told me I was a princess. The locket held a picture of my father, an Argonaut sailor, when centuries were just buttons of pearl, and time hung around her neck like this silver locket. I had a dream very recently that I was hugging this giant cylinder of Shalimar perfume. That was my mother's perfume. Shalimar is a Guerlain perfume that became almost the most famous French perfume in America in the late 60s, 70s, when Catherine Deneuve was used as the spokesman for their huge ad campaign. And I myself, as some of you know, also wear a Guerlain perfume, but it's a very obscure one. So this is called Shalimar Last Night. A glass cylinder of Shalimar perfume as tall as the door, its girth a barrel. So much. Why would I want so much of my mother's perfume? In the 40s, it came in the small scallop-shaped crystal bottle with a pansy dark fan for a stopper made for ballerina fingers to hold and pass against any woman's small wrist. How she wanted satin ballroom slippers, sparkling long necklaces, chiffon dresses that would twirl in the wind while she was dancing on the pier at Long Beach where she met my father, the sailor. My mother one of the 12 dancing princesses of fairy tale who could not stop dancing until their shoes were worn each night into rags. No matter what else she never had, she did have forever that image of herself dancing on the Long Beach pier with my father. I always wondered if they saw the diamond dog as it too leaped around their glittering feet. When my father left, the dog went with him. Ideas of womanhood come from pages, not people. Mama's expensive perfume, though hers had been bought cheap at PX stores during World War II, became the most famous perfume in America, while mine, Mitsuku, also expensive, is so obscure it disappears on me like the cap of darkness when I wear it. These dreams I have become substantial, though they have no fragrance. I hugged the giant bottle of Shalimar last night, as I could never hug my mother. This next poem appeared in another form in the Bread Loaf Anthology, but I think I've done something to make it work better, and part of that involved adding the diamond dog to it. The poem is called The Path of Silver Shoes. Many of you will know this, but some won't. And I was thinking about it. In the original Wizard of Oz, the first book by Frank Baum, Dorothy's magic shoes are silver. It was Hollywood, Walt Disney, the advent of Technicolor that made them want to invent the ruby slippers so we could see that beautiful red Technicolor. And I suspect it was Hollywood that really turned those shoes into what looked like tap dance shoes. I think I'll dedicate this poem tonight to a friend in the audience, Dennis Hall, who inspired me, not to do it, but to think about it, because when he retired, he started taking tap dance lessons. It seemed like a great thing for an old person to do. Not that you're old, Dennis, but I am. The Path of the Silver Shoes. If this were a tap dance studio and my costume for the dance could be a green feather boa, my mother's sequined bra topped by my father's navy hat, I'd put on silver tap shoes and I'd find a way. I'd find the ocean off the alley. I'd find the sounds of silver dollars. I'd find a seashell so big I could sleep in it with green feathers sheltering me, the silver eyes of the diamond dog following my father but never noticing me. The shoes tied with green and silver ribbons would let me rest until I felt as if I could tap all the way across the world. I'd never take them off. I'd offer anyone who wanted it a chance to listen to the silver wheat of Kansas that Dorothy felt drawing her. But I would not return ever to the Midwest. I'd find a tap dance studio in the middle of the ocean. I'd find my father's World War II aircraft carrier and telephone the Wizard of Oz behind his green curtain. I'd wait for Sister Moon, holding me in rapid staccato of light, to slide down and wrap me in her silver cloak. It would match my shoes, and together we'd tap dance, tap dance, tap dance a path pricked with silver and lined with oxygen green that anyone, even my father and his diamond dog, would want to follow. A few years ago at Thanksgiving, I was as sick as I've ever been in my life. I had a burst appendix and wound up in the hospital for 10 days. I had a vision while I was there. I am not a mystical person. I have never had mystic or psychic experiences. I don't think I've ever even had a vision, other than as poets loosely refer to their ideas as visions. And it would be absurd to think that this was actually a mystic experience. It was clearly morphine that gave me this vision. On the other hand, it made me have some sense of what people feel like when they see UFOs or have some experience that's outside the normal. This poem is divided in two parts. It's called The Blue Ice Wolf. And the first part was what I wrote after my experience in the hospital. And it wasn't until this past year that I realized that the blue ice wolf was a version of my diamond dog. So I wrote the second part of the poem. Here's The Blue Ice Wolf, The Visitation, Part One. Like a paper with a bent corner, haphazardly stuffed in an accordion file, I was lying at midnight in a hospital room. It was cold enough to keep a yellow rose in a styrofoam cup fresh for 10 days. There was only a film between waking and sleeping, nothing opaque. Eyes open or closed absorbed the same images. Thus, whether it was a waking sight or one from sleep is only surmise. But with quick solidity, it was there, standing oblique to the corner of my bed, tall as a man's shoulder and motionless, his eyes looking straight ahead rather than at me. I myself was shivering, as I often did there at night, but seeing this presence, I forgot my discomfort and murmured, as those who are ill speak often without sound, "The blue ice wolf." His coat, as Stevens says of junipers, was shagged with ice. Even though friends have told me that my apparition was benevolent, that wolves are protectors, companions, kindly escorts, some part of me thought I saw one of death's messengers. It felt Egyptian to me, yet neither a jackal nor Anubis of the desert. No, the ice was there, like the chips of it that were my only sustenance that week, shaping or glinting his coat until it was crusted and bejeweled. The blue ice wolf was there to accompany me as I trod underground paths. Now, when I peek out from that place I was a few weeks ago, I see his shadow still alert, watching, not me, but everything that comes near. Listening, I think, to my papery breath that moves and rustles even in recovery. He is watching over me as if he is a father. Part two, Incomplete Dawn. I didn't know until now that he was my diamond dog. Once born of the ash heap near the orange grove, in this morning's incomplete dawn, the creature lopes next to my invisible king of Spain. Like feet, soft feet, bare, sponging into the carpet. There is light outside the window from all the planets, the cosmos, in the blue house where students live. I see open pages of the geometry text and hear Sarah's coded syllables explain the dancer's foot pointing out. It's the bird wing in the arch, even though its extension is pliable, and the fractaled knee, all movements shaded rather than crisp. Hillary saw pillars in her mouth, and Adrienne said architecture is power. Fragments cling to my palette, wisp or rags left on hangers. Kavafi saw the boy's yielding face, but I look in the mirror and see the bent foot. I want to hold it in my hand, his foot, the padded muscles of Robert's arms around me. What longing, what is there but touch? Inside, I place one foot over the other. No, we always have our own flesh to accept and reassure us in the morning when everything looks ready. To what? Wrap us up in a quilt? Keep us warm? Notice the toes wriggling out? Teasing air, taking for granted each breath, remembering the softness. Even in the blast from the icy polish and shine off my father's military shoe, transformed into the shimmer of the dog's diamond paw, then the ice wolf's blue one, finally the king of Spain's luscious royal foot, gloved, glinting gold. And I know that at last, they've come back and are waiting till it's time for me to follow them. There are three more poems. This poem is called Not Gary Snyder's Axe Handles. Those of you who know Gary Snyder's poetry, you know that he has a very famous poem called Axe Handles. That's an adjunct or partner to a translation of a classical Chinese poem with about passing things on. So the axe handle is passed on and a new blade is put into it with each generation. And Gary was writing this poem obviously for his son, one of his sons, and he's also writing in Axe Handles about what poets pass on to each other. I can't claim to be writing about either of those things, which is one of the reasons I called this not Gary Snyder's Axe Handle, but I am thinking about things that you hold and you keep, and you certainly probably should not pass them on, although the way our familial lives work, we often do pass them on. And part of what I'm alluding to is my anger here. Anger over all kinds of things that probably deserve some other emotion, but for me, they get translated into anger. I'm happy to report that Robert said to me a few weeks ago, "You don't seem to be as angry anymore, Diane." Maybe. I don't have much to be angry about, except getting old and whatever. You'll want to know, and it doesn't have anything to do with Gary Snyder, the person in this poem is a poet. It's Galway Canal, a poet whom I have admired and whose poetry I've taught and loved all my life. And I've always been sad, but maybe it's turning into anger, that he has never been even remotely interested in my poetry. And if you've ever seen a picture of Galway Canal or seen him in person, you know that he has this kind of face that might, in the cliche, be described as a hatchet-like face. So there's the image of the axe. Galway does live in Vermont, and the poem takes place, or it was written and takes place, when Robert and I were at the Vermont Studio Center. Actually, Michael Rodriguez was there with us, too. And the three of us, often after dinner, would go down to the local tavern and have a drink and talk about what we'd been doing. And I suppose that would make me make the reference to the tavern, because those Greek tavernas where I used to drink Retsina are in the next poem. Not Gary Snyder's Axe Handles. Facing the door, I saw it momentarily, only a half visage, a sketch of cheek and broad nose, like a hatchet stuck in the empty door, then gone. I knew who it was, and I knew why he quickly withdrew when he saw me inside. "You're imagining it, Diane. He isn't even in town," my companion tells me. "He's across the state." Of course, it was I who brought his face to the door of the tavern, just like Greece, only no Retsina. His face an eerie weapon. Will it be embedded in every portal now, its handle holding my anger, wielding its immense heft, levering its blade firmly into every imagined door? Why do I cling to the figure of the axe stuck in the wood and holding fast? I might as well say the diamond dog was there in the doorway, too. I didn't say that, though. This poem, I spent a summer on the island of Hydra in Greece, which is supposedly the island where Leonard Cohen wrote his song about Suzanne, tea and oranges and so forth. I never saw Leonard Cohen there. I spent that summer with one of my very bad husbands, whom I adored, and who was off having assignations with men. and not sleeping with me. So I suppose this poem is about the kinds of things in one life that occasion anger, but And I know that all of you have had a classical education, so you do know what the Maenads are. They are those Dionysian female worshipers who tear apart in their revelry the men they encounter. The title of this poem is at the first line, on Leonard Cohen's Greek Island, where he sang to Suzanne about tea and oranges, where I lived with the dancing bull from Ariadne's labyrinth, where the thread broke and I remained lost, where sailors danced with each other at night in the taverna, their diamond dogs following them back to ships at dawn. I became a Maenad. There, the beauty was inanimate and hung in summer air like bedsheets wet on a line, sodden, too heavy to stir. And there I tossed every night in the damp sheets of beauty's bed and never dreamed of what flesh I might ritually dismember, minotaur or dancing sailor. Like beauty, I was inanimate, never found the rush, never the ecstasy, never tore apart what I desired. This last poem I owe to Jim Porter, a wonderful reader and teacher of creative writing. He's an adjunct in our department, and Jim and I like to meet and talk about writing and reading. From that, I actually know that he's a wonderful fiction writer. I've been reading one of his excellent novellas. And he did me the favor of reading an early version of this manuscript of Diamond Dog poems and wrote some wonderful criticism of it for me. But with relationship to this poem, I should have known this. You know, how can I have been teaching mythology for a million years and not realized that my diamond dog was a version of Cerberus, the dog who guards the gates of the underworld? But I didn't think of it, and Jim did. Yay for good readers. Thank you. That's why we need critics. That's what Jim was. Well, never mind. Anyway, this poem is called Cerberus. And I think of it as the last poem in the bigger manuscript. So that's what you've been running toward, Diamond Dog. I thought you jumped out of the ash heap to follow my father, who himself was walking away from me, past the palm tree with a trunk as wide as an old redwood, away past the neighbor's lantana hedge that drew butterflies, past the friend's church, and down to the boulevard, the King's Highway, El Camino Real. But you weren't heading toward San Diego to my father's World War II aircraft carrier. You weren't following, you were leading. All these years I thought you were following him away from me. Why didn't I realize you had been crushed into diamond by the heat and pressure of the underworld? Perhaps you only tumbled out of the ashes in my dream because I had been trying to breach a place forbidden to the living. Diamond Dog, you've come after me in my 70th year. Now it is I you are leading, not my dead father. No longer are you an image of beauty deserting me, but of mortality or immortality. Either one, the same panting diamond breath. Thank you for listening. I'll get rid of this so that it doesn't make any noise.
What a conclusion. But I have three things to say before you all depart. First of all, for those of you who, we have a commemorative poster that was signed by all four poets for sale in the back for only $10. And several people ordered them before. We couldn't get them all signed until everyone had been here and read. Julie's holding one up. So if you ordered one and signed up for it and already paid for it, please pick it up. If you would like to order one, you can get it, and you can have anybody else here sign it you would like. They'll be glad to do that. And I'm sure Diane would sign some books back there. So that's one thing. The second thing is please stick around and have some refreshments. And the third thing is thank you all for supporting this series, and we hope you'll be back in April when we have more readings. Thank you very much.